Chapter 9. A Curious Tale for Countess Amberglass. 1. At 10:30 the 10th hour of the evening on Duke's Day, as low dark clouds fell in above Camor, blotting out the stars and the moons, Doña Sofia Salvara was being hoisted up into the sky to have a late tea with Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, at the top of the great lady's elderglass tower. The passenger cage rattled and swayed, and Sophia clung to the black iron bars for support. The sweaty hangman's wing fluttered at her hooded coat as she stared south. All of the city lay spread beneath her, black and grey from horizon to horizon, suffused with the glow of fire and alchemy. This was a point of quiet pride for her every time she had the chance to take in this view from one of the five towers. The Eldrin had built glass wonders for men to claim. Engineers had crafted buildings of stone and wood in the Eldrin ruins to make the cities their own. Bonds Magi pretended to the powers the Eldrin must have once held. But it was alchemy that drove back the darkness every evening. Alchemy that lit the commonest home and the tallest tower alike, cleaner and safer than natural fire. It was her art that tamed the night. At last, her long ascent ended. The cage rattled to a halt beside an embarkation platform 4/5 of the way up Amberglass' full height. The wind sighed mournfully in the strange fluted arches at the peak of the tower. Two footmen in cream-white waistcoats and immaculate white gloves and breeches helped her out of the cage, as they might have assisted her from a carriage down on the ground. Once she was safely on the platform, the two men bowed from the waist.
"Milady Salvara," said the one on the left, "my mistress bids you welcome to Amberglass."
"Most kind," said Doña Sofia.
"If it would please you to wait on the terrace, she will join you momentarily."
The same footman led the way past 6 servants in similar livery, who stood panting beside the elaborate arrangement of gears, levers, and chains they worked to haul the cargo cage up and down. They, too, bowed as she passed. She favoured them with a smile and an acknowledging wave. It never hurt to be pleasant to the servants in charge of that particular operation. Doña Vorcenza's terrace was a wide crescent of transparent elderglass jutting out from the north face of her tower, surrounded by brass safety rails. Doña Sofia looked straight down, as she had always been warned not to do, and as she always did. It seemed that she and the footman walked on thin air 40 stories above the stone courtyards and storage buildings at the base of the tower. Alchemical lamps were specks of light, and carriages were black squares smaller than one of her nails. On her left, visible through a series of tall arched windows whose sills were on a level with her waist, were dimly lit apartments and parlours within the tower itself. Doña Vorcenza had very few living relatives and no children. She was effectively the last of a once powerful clan, and there was little doubt, among the grasping, ambitious nobles of the Alchegrante slopes at least, that Amberglass would pass to some new family upon her death. Most of her tower was dark and quiet, most of its opulence packed away in closets and chests. The old lady still knew how to host a late-night tea, however. At the far northwestern corner of her transparent terrace, with a commanding view of the lightless countryside to the north of the city, a silk awning fluttered in the hangman's wind. Tall alchemical lanterns in cages of gold-gilded brass hung from the four corners of the awning, shedding warm light on the little table and the two high-backed chairs arranged therein. The footman placed a thin black cushion upon the right-hand chair and pulled it out for her. With a swish of skirts, she settled into it and nodded her thanks. The man bowed and strolled away, taking up a watch at a point that was politely out of earshot but within easy beckoning distance. Sophia did not have long to wait for her hostess. A few minutes after her arrival, old Doña Vorcenza appeared out of a wooden door on the tower's north wall. Age has a way of exaggerating the physical traits of those who live to feel its strains. The round tend to grow rounder, and the slim tend to waste away. Time had narrowed Angiovesta Vorcenza. She was not so much withered as collapsed, a spindly living caricature like a wooden idol animated by the sorcery of sheer willpower. 70 was a fading memory for her, yet she still moved about without an escort on her arm or a cane in her hands. She dressed eccentrically in a black velvet frock coat with fur collars and cuffs. Eschewing the cascading petticoats the ladies of her era had favoured, she actually wore black pantaloons and silver slippers. Her white hair was pulled back and fixed with lacquered pins. Her dark eyes were bright behind her half-moon optics.
"Sophia," she said as she stepped daintily beneath the awning, "what a pleasure it is to have you up here again. It's been months, my dear girl, months. No, do sit. Pulling out my own chair holds no terrors for me. Ah, tell me, how is Lorenzo? And surely we must speak of your garden."
"Lorenzo and I are well, considered solely in ourselves. And the garden thrives, Doña Vorcenza. Thank you for asking."
"Considered solely in yourselves? Then there is something else? Something, dare I pry, external?"
A night tea in Camor was a womanly tradition when one wished to seek the advice of another, or simply make use of a sympathetic ear while expressing regrets or complaints, most frequently concerning men.
"You may pry, Doña Vorcenza, by all means. And yes, yes, external is a very proper term for it."
"But it's not Lorenzo."
"Oh, no. Lorenzo is satisfactory in every possible respect."
Sophia sighed and glanced down at the illusion of empty air beneath her feet and her chair.
"It's both of us that may be in need of advice."
"Advice?" chuckled Doña Vorcenza. "The years play a sort of alchemical trick, transmuting one's mutterings to a state of respectability. Give advice at 40 and you're a nag. Give it at 70 and you're a sage."
"Doña Vorcenza," said Sophia, "you have been of great help to me before. I couldn't think, well, there was no one else I was comfortable speaking to about this matter for the time being."
"Indeed. Well, dear girl, I'm eager to be of whatever help I can. But here's our tea. Come, let us indulge ourselves for a few moments."
One of Doña Vorcenza's jacketed attendants wheeled a silver-domed cart toward them and slid it into place beside the little table. When he whisked the dome away, Sophia saw that the cart held a gleaming silver tea service and a subtlety. A perfect culinary replica of amber glass tower, barely 9 inches high, complete with minuscule specks of alchemical light dotting its turrets. The little glass globes were not much larger than raisins.
"You see how little real work I give to my poor chef," said Doña Vorcenza, cackling. "He suffers in the service of such a plain and simple palate. He takes his revenge with these surprises. I cannot order a soft-boiled egg, but that he finds a dancing chicken to lay it directly on my plate. Tell me, Gil, is that edifice truly edible?"
"So I am assured, my Lady Vorcenza, save for the tiny lights. The tower itself is spice cake. The turrets and terraces are jellied fruit. The buildings and carriages at the base of the tower are mostly chocolate. The heart of the tower is an apple brandy cream, and the windows..."
"Thank you, Gil. That will do for an architectural synopsis. But spit out the lights when we're finished, you say?"
"It would be more decorous, milady," said the servant,
a round, delicate-featured man with shoulder-length black ringlets, "to let me remove them for you prior to consumption."
"Decorous? Gil, you would deny us the fun of spitting them over the side of the terrace like little girls. I'll thank you not to touch them. The tea?"
"Your will, Doña Vorcenza," he said smoothly. "Tea of light."
He lifted a silver teapot and poured a steaming line of pale brownish liquid into a tea glass. Doña Vorcenza's etched glasses were shaped like large tulip buds with silver bases. As the tea settled into the container, it began to glow faintly, shedding an inviting orange radiance.
"Oh, very pretty," said Doña Sofia. "I've heard of it. Verrari, isn't it?"
"Lasciani."
Doña Vorcenza took the glass from Gil and cradled it in both hands.
"Quite the latest thing. Their tea masters are mad with the competitive spirit. This time next year we'll have something even stranger to one-up one another with. But forgive me, my dear, I do hope you're not averse to drinking the products of your art as well as working with them in your garden."
"Not at all,"
Sofia replied as the servant set her own glass before her and bowed. She took the cup into her hands and took a deep breath. The tea smelled of mingled vanilla and orange blossoms. When she sipped, the flavors ran warmly on her tongue, and the scented steam rose into her nostrils. Gil vanished back into the tower itself, while the ladies commenced drinking. For a few moments they enjoyed their tea in appreciative silence, and for a few moments Sofia was almost content.
"Now we shall see,"
said Doña Vorcenza, as she set her half-empty glass down before her,
"if it continues to glow when it comes out the other side."
Doña Salvara giggled despite herself, and the lines on her hostess' lean face drew upward as she smiled.
"Now, what did you want to ask me about, my dear?"
"Doña Vorcenza," Sofia began, then hesitated. It is commonly thought that you have some means to communicate with the Duke's secret constabulary."
"The Duke has a secret constabulary?"
Doña Vorcenza placed a hand against her breast in an expression of polite disbelief.
"The Midnighters, Doña Vorcenza, the Midnighters and their leader..."
"The Duke's spider. Yes, yes. Forgive me, dear girl, I do know of what you speak, but this idea you have, commonly thought, you say? Many things are commonly thought, but perhaps not commonly thought all the way through."
"It is very curious," said Sofia Salvara, "that when the Doñas come to you with problems, on more than one occasion their problems have reached the ear of the spider, or seem to, since the Duke's men became involved in assisting with those problems."
"Oh, my dear Sofia, when gossip comes to me, I pass it on in packets and parcels. I drop a word or two in the right ear, and the gossip acquires a life of its own. Sooner or later, it must reach the notice of someone who will take action."
"Doña Vorcenza," said Sofia, "I hope I can say without intending or giving offence that you are dissembling."
"I hope I can say without disappointing you, dear girl, that you have a very slender basis for making that suggestion."
"Doña Vorcenza,"
Sofia clutched at her edge of the table so hard that several of her finger joints popped,
"Lorenzo and I are being robbed."
"Robbed? Whatever do you mean?"
"And we have Midnighters involved. They've made the most extraordinary claims and made requests of us. But, Doña Vorcenza, there must be some way to confirm that they are what they say they are."
"You say Midnighters are robbing you?"
"No," said Sofia, biting her upper lip. "No, it's not the Midnighters themselves. They are supposedly watching the situation and waiting for a chance to act. But something is just wrong, or they are not telling us everything they perhaps should."
"My dear Sofia," said Doña Vorcenza, "my poor troubled girl, you must tell me exactly what has happened, and leave out not one detail."
"It is difficult, Doña Vorcenza. The situation is rather embarrassing and complicated."
"We are all alone up here on my terrace, my dear. You have done all the hard work already in coming over to see me. Now you must tell me everything. Then I'll see to it that this particular bit of gossip speeds on its way to the right ear, I promise you."
Sofia took another small sip of tea, cleared her throat, and hunched down in her seat to look Doña Vorcenza directly in the eyes.
"Surely,"
she began. "You've heard of Osterschalin brandy, Doña Vorcenza?"
"More than heard of, my dear. I may even have a few bottles hidden away in my wine cabinets."
"And you know how it is made? The secrets surrounding it?"
"Oh, I believe I understand the essence of the Osterschalin mystique. The fussy, black-coated vintners of Emberlane are, shall we say, well served by the stories surrounding their wares."
"Then you can understand, Doña Vorcenza, how Lorenzo and I reacted as we did when the following opportunity supposedly fell into our laps by an act of the gods." 2. The cage containing Doña Salvara creaked and rattled toward the ground, growing ever smaller and fading into the background grey of the courtyard. Doña Vorcenza stood by the brass rails of the embarkation platform, staring into the night for many minutes, while her team of attendants pulled at the machinery of the capstan. Gil wheeled the silver cart with the near-empty pot of tea and the half-eaten amber-glass cake past her, and she turned to him.
"No," she said, "send the cake up to the solarium. That's where we'll be."
"Who, milady?"
"Reynard."
She was already striding back toward the door to her terrace-side apartments. Her slippered feet made an echoing slap, slap, slap against the walkway.
"Find Reynard. I don't care what he's doing. Find him and send him up to me the moment you've seen to the cake."
Inside the suite of apartments, through a locked door, up a curving stairway, Doña Vorcenza cursed under her breath. Her knees, her feet, her ankles.
"Damn venerability," she muttered. "I piss on the gods for the gift of rheumatism."
Her breathing was ragged. She undid the buttons on the front of her fur-trimmed coat as she continued to mount the steps. At the top, the very peak of the inner tower, there was a heavy oaken door reinforced with iron joints and bands. She pulled forth a key that hung around her right wrist on a silk cord. This she inserted into the silver lockbox above the crystal knob, while carefully pressing a certain decorative brass plate in a wall sconce. A series of clicks echoed within the walls, and the door fell open, inward. Forgetting the brass plate would be a poor idea, she'd specified a rather excessive pull for the concealed crossbow trap when she'd had it installed 3 decades earlier. This was the solarium, then, another 8 stories up from the level of the terrace. The room took up the full diameter of the tower at its apex, 50 feet from edge to edge. The floor was thickly carpeted. A long, curving, brass-railed gallery with stairs at either end spread across the northern half of the space. This gallery held a row of tall witchwood shelves divided into thousands upon thousands of cubbyholes and compartments. The transparent hemispherical ceiling dome revealed the low clouds like a bubbling lake of smoke. Doña Vorcenza tapped alchemical globes to bring them to life as she mounted the stairs to her file gallery. There she worked, engrossed, heedless of the passage of time as her narrow fingers flicked from compartment to compartment. She pulled out some piles of parchment and set them aside, half considered others and pushed them back in, muttering remembrances and conjecture under her breath. She snapped out of her fugue only when the solarium door clicked open once more. The man who entered was tall and broad-shouldered. He had an angular Vajran face and ice-blonde hair pulled back in a ribbon-bound tail. He wore a ribbed leather doublet over slashed black sleeves, with black breeches and tall black boots. The little silver pins at his collar gave him the rank of captain in the Nightglass Company. The black jackets, the Duke's own, a rapier with straight quillons hung at his right hip.
"Stephen," said Doña Vorcenza without preamble, "have any of your boys or girls paid a recent visit to Don and Doña Salvara on the Isla Durona?"
"The Salvaras? No, certainly not, milady."
"You're sure? Absolutely sure?"
Parchments in hand, eyebrows arched, she stalked down the steps, barely keeping her balance.
"I need certain truth from you right now, as badly as I ever have."
"I know the Salvaras, milady. I met them both at last year's Day of Changes feast. I rode up to the Sky Garden in the same cage with them.
And you haven't sent any of the Midnighters to pay them a visit?
12 gods, no, not one.
Then someone is abusing our good name, Stephen, and I think we may finally have the Thorn of Camor.
Reynard stared at her, then grinned.
You're joking. You're not? Pinch me, I must be dreaming. What's the situation?
First things first. I know you think fastest when we nurse that damned sweet tooth of yours. Peek inside the dumb waiter. I'm going to have a seat.
Oh my,
said Reynard, peering into the chain hoist shaft that held the dumb waiter.
It looks as though someone's already made a merry work of this poor spice cake. I'll put it out of its misery. There's wine and glasses, too. Looks like one of your sweet whites.
God's bless Giel. I'd forgotten to ask him for that. I was in such haste to get to my files. Be a dear, dutiful subordinate and pour us a glass.
Dear, dutiful subordinate, indeed. For the cake, I'd polish your slippers as well.
I'll hold that promise in reserve for the next time you vex me, Stephen. Oh, fill the glass. I'm not 13 years old. Now, take your seat and listen to this. If everything signifies, as I believe it shall, the bastard has just been delivered to us right in the middle of one of his schemes.
How so?
I'll answer a question with a question, Stephen.
She took a deep draught of her white wine and settled back into her chair.
Tell me, how much do you know of the body of law surrounding Osterschalen Brandy?
3.
Posing as one of us,
Reynard mused after she'd finished her tale.
The sheer fucking cheek! But are you sure it's the Thorn?
If it isn't, then we could only presume that we now have another equally skilled and audacious thief picking the pockets of my peers. And I think that's presuming a bit much, even for a city crammed as full of ghosts as this one.
Mightn't it be the Grey King? He's the right sort of slippery, by all reports.
No. The Grey King's been murdering Barsavi's men. The Thorn's mode of operation is plain trickery. Not a drop of real blood shed yet, as near as I can tell. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Reynard set aside his empty cake plate and took a sip from his glass of wine.
So, if we can trust Doña Salvara's story, we're looking at a gang of at least 4 men. The Thorn himself, let's call him Lucas Fairwhite for the sake of argument, his servant Grauman, and the 2 men who broke into the Salvara estate.
That's a beginning, Stephen. But I'd say the gang is more probably 5 or 6.
How do you figure?
I believe the false Midnighter was telling the truth when he told Don Salvara that the attack near the Temple of Fortunate Waters was staged. It would have to be for a scheme this complex. So we have 2 more accomplices, the masked attackers.
Assuming they weren't just hired for the task.
I doubt it. Consider the total paucity of information we've had previous to this. Not 1 report, 1 boast, 1 slender whisper from anyone, anywhere. Not a speck of information pointing to anyone who even claimed to work with the Thorn of Camor. Yet on any given day, thieves will boast loudly for hours about who among them can piss the farthest. This silence is unnatural.
Well, said Reynard, if you just slit a hireling's throat when he's done his job, you don't have to pay him either.
But we're still dealing with the Thorn, and I hold that such an act would be outside his pattern of operations.
So his gang runs a closed shop. That would make sense.
But it still might not be six. The two in the alley could also be the two who entered the estate dressed as midnighters.
Oh, my dear Stephen, an interesting conjecture. Let us say four minimum, six maximum is our first guess, or we'll be here all night drawing diagrams for one another. I suspect anything larger would be difficult to hide as well as they have.
So be it, then. Reynard thought for a moment. I can give you 15 or 16 swords right this very hour. Some of my lads are mumming it up tonight down in the snare on the cauldron, since we got those reports of Nazca Barsavi's funeral. I can't pull them on short notice, but give me until the dark of the morning and I can have everyone else kitted up and ready for a scrap. We've got the night glass to back us. No need to even bring the yellow jackets in on it. We know they're probably compromised anyway.
That would be well, Stephen, if I wanted them snatched up right now, but I don't. I think we have a few days, at least, to draw the web tight around this man. Sophia said they discussed an initial outlay of about 25,000 crowns. I suspect the Thorn will wait around to collect the other 7 or 8 he's due.
At least let me hold a squad ready, then. I'll keep them at the Palace of Patience. Tuck them in amongst the yellow jackets. They can be ready to dash off with 5 minutes' notice.
Very prudent. Do so. Now, as for how we move on the Thorn himself, send someone down to Maraggio's tomorrow, the subtlest you have. See if Fairwhite holds an account there, and when it was begun.
Calviro. I'll send Maralisa Calviro.
An excellent choice. As far as I'm concerned, anyone else this Fairwhite has introduced the Salvaras to is suspect. Have her check up on the law scribe she said her husband met just after the staged attack behind the temple.
Ecari, wasn't it? Evante Ecari.
Yes. And then I want you to check out the Temple of Fortunate Waters.
Me? M'lady, you of all people know I don't keep the faith. I just inherited the looks.
But you can fake the faith. And it's the looks I need. They'll keep you from being too suspicious. Case the place. Look for anyone out of sorts. Look for gangs or goings-on. It's remotely possible someone at the temple was in on the staged attack. Even if that's not so, we need to eliminate it as a possibility.
It's as good as done, then. And what about their inn?
The Tumble Home, yes. Send one person and one person only. I have a pair of old informants on the staff. One of them thinks he's reporting to the Yellow Jackets, and one thinks she's working for the copper. I'll pass the names along. For now, I just want to find out if they're still there, at the Bowsprit Suite. If they are, you can place a few of your men there dressed as staff. Observation only, for the time being.
Very well. Reynard rose from his chair and brushed crumbs from his breeches. And the noose? Assuming you get your wish, where and when would you like to draw it tight?
Going after the Thorn has always been like trying to grab fish with bare hands, she replied. I'll want him sewn up somewhere, some place where escape will be impossible, cut off from his friends, and entirely surrounded by ours.
By ours? How? Oh, Raven's Reach.
Yes, very good, Stephen. The day of changes, just a week and a half from now. The Duke's Midsummer Feast. 500 feet in the air, surrounded by the peers of Camor and 100 guards. I'll instruct Doña Sofia to invite this Lucas Fairwhite to dine with the Duke as a guest of the Salvaras.
Assuming he doesn't suspect a trap.
I think it's just the sort of gesture he'd appreciate. I think our mysterious friend's audacity is going to be what finally arranges our direct introduction. I shall have Sophia feign financial distress. She can tell Fairwhite that the last few thousand crowns won't be forthcoming until after the festival. A double-baited hook, his greed hand in hand with his vanity. I dare say he'll relish the temptation.
Shall I pull everyone in for it?
Of course.
Doña Vorcenza sipped her wine and smiled slowly.
I want a midnighter to take his coat. I want midnighters serving him before the meal. If he uses a chamber pot, I want a midnighter to close it for him afterward. We'll take him atop Raven's Reach. Then we'll watch the ground to see who runs and where they run to.
Anything else?
No. Get to it, Stephen. Come back and let me have your report in a few hours. I'll still be up. I'm expecting messages from the floating grave once Barsavi's funeral procession gets back. In the meantime, I'll send old Nicovante a note about what we suspect.
Your servant, milady.
Reynard bowed briefly and then departed the solarium, his strides long and rapid. Before the heavy door had even slammed shut, Doña Vorcenza was up and moving toward a small scrivener's desk tucked into an alcove to the left of the door. There she withdrew a half-sheet of parchment, scribbled a few hasty lines, folded it, and closed the fold with a small dollop of blue wax from a paper tube. The stuff was alchemical, hardening after a few moments of exposure to air. She preferred to allow no sources of open flame into this room, with its many decades of carefully collected and indexed records. Within the desk was a signet ring that Doña Vorcenza never wore outside her solarium. On that ring was a sigil that appeared nowhere on the crest of the Vorcenza family. She pressed the ring into the stiffening blue wax and then withdrew it with a slight popping noise. When she passed it down the dumbwaiter, one of her night attendants would immediately run to the northeastern cage platform of her tower and have himself cranked over to Raven's Reach via cable car. There, he would place the message directly into the old Duke's hands, even if Nicovante had retired to his bedchamber. Such was the custom with every note that was sealed in blue with nothing but the stylized sigil of a spider for its credentials.